Amen. Thank you, worship team. Let's continue in worship by approaching the sacred scripture. You may be seated. I invite you, if you have your own Bible on you, to turn to Philippians chapter 1. If you don't, there's a red-orange pew Bible in your vicinity, under the chair in front of you or under your own. And Paul's epistle to the Philippians is on page 196 in the back half of the book. We introduced this book last week, and what's unique about this book is there's no real problem Paul's addressing. Every other epistle, he's addressing some kind of issue that's arisen in the church, usually a problem that he, as the pastor and founder of the church, must address. Here, there's no problem we talked about last week. This is completely a letter of thanksgiving. Thanksgiving for the Philippians supporting him during his imprisonment. And he's going to update on his situation because the Philippians are obviously concerned for how he's doing. They know he's in prison. They know that when he went to visit Jerusalem, he was unfairly arrested. And when the authorities couldn't figure out what to do with him, he appealed to Caesar. That sent him on a ship through over the Mediterranean to Rome, where once he was there in Rome, he gets caught up in bureaucracy and red tape, and pretty much rots unforgotten for about 2 years. It's somewhere in that 2 years that he writes this letter to the Philippians, and we have to realize he certainly had every reason to be frustrated and demoralized and depressed, because this is a founding pastor. He's a traveling apostle. His job is to plant churches and to preach the gospel to others and to serve in the name of Christ. And he can't do most of that with his hands tied behind his back in prison. He can't move about. He can't interact with people in a major way. He certainly can't preach in a public way. And so everything his life is about has been taken from him. And so the Philippians know that, and they want to know how he's doing. And Paul, right now in the passage we're going to look at tonight, verses 12 through 18, is going to give an update. And you would think maybe it's an update on how he's doing, but Paul's going to do a typical Pauline thing. He's going to pretend to talk about himself, but immediately talk about the gospel. I mean, he's going to update on how things are going for him, but that update really is on how the gospel is progressing. Notice what he does. This is Paul at his best. Verse 12. I want you to know, beloved, and we're perked to hear the update, that what has happened to me has actually helped to spread the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone else that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers and sisters, having been made confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, dare to speak the word with greater boldness and without fear. That opening line is very leading, but it doesn't lead to where I think the Philippians were expecting. I want you to know, beloved, how I'm doing. I'd imagine their questions were, Paul, are you well? Are you comfortable? Are you cold? Are you alone or with someone? Are you eating well? How are things? Give us an update on your situation, Paul. And Paul says, I want you to know, here's how my situation is. The gospel is advancing. I thought it there might be a setback. I'm plugged away in prison. I can't travel. I can't preach publicly. I can't do any of the things that are part of my vocation. But here's what's happened, verse 12, to me. It's actually helped, which is crazy talk, because he's in prison. But he says, this has helped to spread the gospel, so that it has become known throughout, and the Greek word is the whole praetorium. You might have heard that in some of the movies that we get about Roman gladiators and such. A praetorium is either a allocation of imperial guards, or it's actually the governor's residence, which is to say, either the whole imperial guard, or the government and people in high places, or both, the whole imperial guard or praetorium, have heard the gospel. And so Paul takes what is lemon and he turns it into lemonade, because this is not a good situation. This isn't Paul doing what he loves to do. And yet he says, you know what? What I thought was bad has actually helped spread the gospel, and people are hearing it that never would have heard it by any other means. And not only that, there's more good news that verse 14, most of the brothers and sisters, that would be fellow Christians in Rome, having been made confident in the Lord by my imprisonment. dare to speak the word with greater boldness and greater fear. So his enduring of his imprisonment has inspired his fellow free Christians to have courage and to not fear and do the same thing he did that got him locked up in the first place. Paul's excited by all this. This is a joyful man in prison. This is someone who's changed the narrative. This is someone who could have thrown a pity party and said, "Woe is me, I can't do anything I want to do, I'm stuck here in prison." But he actually has changed the narrative to where he says, things couldn't be better. I mean, this is helped, this is advanced, this is encouraged, this has done all the things that I'm about, even though I'm stuck like a mouse in a trap. This has actually accomplished things that I couldn't have dreamed of. And so he's able to put a positive spin on what's a very bleak situation for him. And he's going to take that spin even further because he's just mentioned how some people are emboldened in their witness, but not everyone is emboldened in a positive way. Notice verse 15. This is one of the most interesting paragraphs in the whole letter that you'll never hear preached, but it certainly deserves our attention. Some proclaim Christ, these are those on the outside who've heard and are encouraged, from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. These proclaim Christ out of love, the ones from goodwill, knowing that I've been put here for the defense of the gospel. The others proclaim or preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but intending to increase my suffering in my imprisonment. What does it matter? Just this, that Christ is proclaimed in every way, whether out of false motives or true, and in that I rejoice. Now, I hope you listen carefully, because it's pretty hard to have Paul's attitude. Because Paul has just made a statement about people who are maliciously taking advantage of his absence. He says, some brothers out of goodwill, they love God, they love me, they're trying to advance the gospel, and they are emboldened for good reasons. Some are emboldened for very bad reasons. Selfish ambition, envy, rivalry. They want to increase my suffering in prison. They want to make my life harder. And so Paul says, they're doing it from bad motives. But what does it matter? Christ is preached. And I rejoice about both of these. That to me is a very interesting way to view differences. And that's why it's interesting to note firsthand who are these people, particularly the ones with selfish or envious or rivalrous kind of motives. And you can debate this till the end of time if you want, and scholars do this. There's one thing we know for certain. Whatever they're doing, they are preaching Christ. Their gospel is Paul's gospel. The issue for Paul is not the gospel, because in verse 18 he says they're preaching Christ. Christ is proclaimed in every way. Or verse 17, the others proclaim Christ. So they're preaching Christ. The message is true. It's the motive that's corrupt. Verse 17, they're preaching out of selfish ambition. So we know these are not the group of people that Paul will take issue with. Because there are some people Paul's going to have big problems with and not say, well, what does it matter? You know, more power to them. There are the dogs in chapter 3, verse 2, which seem to be proto-Gnostics. They're hedonistic, they're indulgent, they are allowing grace to be an excuse for horrible misconduct. They're excusing it. So Paul's going to talk about them in chapter 3. He has a big problem with that doctrine. When we get to Galatians and Colossians, Paul has a huge problem with the Judaizers, the people who proclaim that one must become an ethnic Israelite, which means one must be circumcised and enter into Israel's covenant in order to be saved. Paul, to his dying gasp, would fight them tooth and nail. He actually will say in Galatians, they're preaching another Jesus, it's a false gospel, and may they be cursed. Paul's a fighter. Paul's a fighter when it comes to doctrine. Which is why the issue for these rapscallions, the ones that preach Christ from bad motives, can't be doctrine. That's not an issue, otherwise Paul wouldn't rejoice. The issue isn't necessarily horrible misconduct, you know, some kind of profligate indulgence or anything like that. The issue is that they have some pretty stinking motives. The motives that he lists here are envy, rivalry, selfish ambition, and so people wrestle with, okay, envy. Could it be that some of the Christians in Rome are envious because Paul is actually reaching more people in prison than they are out of prison? Some people suggest, well, the rivalry might take us back to 1 Corinthians, written directly before this, where you had rivalrous groups saying, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, I'm of Christ, saying basically we've got our favorite leaders and we'll pit them against one another. And so they want to continue on that kind of conduct. Some will suggest, and you have to get to 2 Corinthians to see this, that these are the super apostles of 2 Corinthians. The super apostles, we'll encounter them in 2 Corinthians, are people who believe, and it's very relevant, that you're only a good gospel minister if you believe in prosperity and healing, and you're a respected member of society. So someone that's experiencing the humiliation and shame of imprisonment, that certainly can't be Christ's servant. That's not a servant of the king. Otherwise, they'd be out of prison. They'd be liberated. They'd be respected. And so Paul's going to have to take on that mentality because he's stuck here in prison, and he's going to have to write 2 Corinthians also from here. So whoever it is, and whatever the issue is, it really is not going to be discovered because people will debate this until the end. The thing I want you to know for sure, certain, is that Paul's issue is not with their malevolent or malicious conduct. They aren't doing anything super indulgent. His issue is not with their doctrine. His issue is they got a bad attitude, and particularly a bad attitude toward him, because they're trying to cause him suffering in prison. So we're going to talk about that when we talk about motives here in just a moment, because it's amazing in verse 18, what does it matter? Just this, that Christ is preached. Now, there are a small handful of theologians that interpret this, what does this matter, as, what does it matter? And they see this as the resignation of a person who's been in prison for 2 years, who's basically saying, nothing matters. What does it matter? You know, I'm stuck here. So they see, not in this I rejoice, just a few words later, they see someone who's a wounded and weary warrior that's giving up and just kind of shrugging resignation. I don't know how people do that when they read the rest of Paul, because Paul's a bulldog. Paul would fight to his dying gasp. This is not someone resigned, and particularly because this letter's overflowing with joy. That's why that's such a minority opinion. The better way to look at this is, what does it matter? As a statement of unity and of tolerance of those with bad motives and of even love for those who seek to do him harm, who seek to increase his suffering. He is showing an incredible spirit of unity because he's able and willing to tolerate the bad motives. He prefers good motives, but he'll take the bad motives because the bad motives are tolerable as long as Christ is preached. Even if the bad motives make his suffering compounded, more difficult, his life more hard, he's still able to say, what does it matter? My life's harder, but the gospel's preached. And you get more of that spirit. Here he is in prison, and this has turned out for the best. It's amazing when you see what Paul does, because for him, it's all about the gospel. And when the gospel shines, Paul rejoices, and somehow he is seen in his imprisonment and in some of the badly motivated preaching of some of his enemies, Christ being preached, and he can't help but rejoice. Now that's our passage. You'll probably never hear this preached on a Sunday morning. You may never hear it preached again, and yet I think it is overflowing with deep and powerful reflections for how we might inhabit the spirit of Paul and try to live as he does. Because we're all going to encounter situations where things don't turn out how we planned. We thought we were going to go to Rome and preach the gospel, but we end up in Rome in a prison cell. We're all going to experience times where we experience people who are malicious, who do not want our welfare, who seek to do us harm by doing what they're doing. So we all can find ourselves in Paul's position at different times, perhaps not as drastic or extreme. And that's why I want to give you three reflections, my three contractual reflections. And I'm happy because I think all of these are really worth, they could each almost be their own message, but we're going to spend the most time on number two. So the first one is this. I want you to notice how Paul changes the narrative, how Paul so wonderfully turns lemons into lemonade. Because Paul certainly has every reason to be disappointed and frustrated there in prison, unable to do what he wants to do. But he doesn't sit there and lick his wounds. He doesn't throw a pity party. Instead, he counts his blessings instead of counting his disappointments. You'll never see Paul do this, which is what I see far too many people doing, and I've done it as well at times, when you experience a change of plans or things are harder than you thought they'd be, and you say, why is this happening to me? You know why that's never a good question? There's no good answer. There will never be an answer that's satisfactory enough as you're suffering and you say, why is this happening to me? And you get an answer and you say, oh, okay, that makes sense. That's sure. I don't know why we ask that question, because it is unanswerable, and therefore it is unhelpful, and it doesn't lead us to any good actions other than the pity party or an overwhelming sense of despair, because there is no answer that's going to satisfy the question, why is this happening to me? Paul never asked that. Instead, Paul will ask himself, what can I do in the situation I'm in? What can I do? How can I find meaning in it? How can I look at the situation I'm in and not allow it to overwhelm me with its frustrations, but instead find the opportunities within it that are blatantly there that perhaps I wouldn't see if I just was focusing on, why is this happening to me? And that's what Paul is doing when he says, I want you to know that this gospel is actually spread, that things are happening that never could have happened otherwise. And that, to me, is Paul changing the narrative. One of the narratives could be poor apostle, horribly misunderstood, imprisoned in Jerusalem, tossed to Rome, forgotten in the prison, and there he sits, unable to do that which makes him happiest. Wah, wah, wah. Because that's all you do. There's nothing that you that's the narrative, and it's the narrative sucks. Yeah, it sucks. Paul instead really does experience all of that and says, you know what? What are the possibilities? How can I look at this narrative different? And of course, he's already got a wonderful narrative within which to view all of our narratives, his narrative and the whole world's narrative, and that is his story is under the umbrella of the gospel. And that he's been called as a minister of Christ Jesus to share that gospel and to be a servant of that gospel. And thus, he's able to find meaning in the proclaiming of that gospel, even in a situation that's less than ideal. In many ways, what I think Paul's doing here is what someone named Viktor Frankl, if you've ever heard of him, discovered about, oh gosh, almost 70 years ago now. Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist, but before he was a psychiatrist, he was a Holocaust survivor. And he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, in which you kind of get the essence of what he wants to say as a psychiatrist having survived the Holocaust, because he discovered in his suffering of the Holocaust that the people who survived, more likely than not, were the people who were able to find meaning in the most difficult of circumstances. If they could not find meaning in their suffering, if they didn't have an overarching story, if they didn't have some way to see some kind of hope in a story bigger than themselves and a bigger than their very immediate sufferings, then they were going to collapse under the weight of that suffering, which was horrible. But if they were able to see that there was meaning, that if nothing else, they would endure as a witness, or that they would stand strong for the sake of their children, or that they would remain committed because they trusted God, or there are all kinds of meanings you could attach, but they were able to see this is going to be endured not simply because suffering exists and I must suffer, but that I'm going to find some meaning in it. And in Victor's understanding of things, if you can discover that for yourself, then you're able to endure perhaps some of the most unmeaningful situations, because you have a bigger story that can swallow that lesser story. That, to me, is what Paul is doing here. He is allowing the big story of the gospel to swallow the smaller story of his own immediate experience and take what is a very difficult circumstance and turn it into an opportunity. An opportunity of advancing the gospel so that his suffering is also a reason why he rejoices. I mean, he's suffering. And yet he says a couple times, even in just this short passage we looked at, rejoicing. Where the Philippians and you and I might see disaster, Paul sees free publicity for the gospel. He sees that, you know, there's no bad publicity. I've got opportunities I never would have had otherwise. So there are many ways we can change the narrative, and we could go deep on this, because we're all constantly telling ourselves our own story. and we're putting it in the context of, oh, I'm horrible, or oh, I'm wonderful, or oh, this is what matters most, or no, this is what matters most. We just are constantly framing our lives within a story, and the challenge is to have a big enough story to encompass the difficult circumstances as well as the good circumstances. And so Paul's changing the narrative. He's a lesson for us in that. But here's where I find the greatest amount of material for reflection, because that second paragraph is all about motives. And here's what's so fun about motives. You can't see them. No matter how hard you try to assess someone's motives, you're probably wrong, because you can't see them. You can pretend you see their insincerity. You can pretend you see their envy. You can pretend you see their pride. But you really can't see them, because you only see actions. You don't see motives. And therefore, they're hard to assess. They're very hard to assess for others. And those of us who do quickly need to get rid of that judgmentalism. But they're just as hard to assess within the depths of our own life. Because the reality is, even though we do things, sometimes we don't do things with the best of motives. We do them begrudgingly. We're not really fully on board. And that's why I find motives so interesting. They're rarely monolithic. We are, for the most part, a mixed bag of motives in everything we do. And I'll put my head on the chopping block and show you how Rich Vincent is a mixed bag of motives in everything he does. I'm not sure I've ever done one thing with a pure motive. And you'll know by the time we're done why that doesn't bother me one bit. All right? Why do I pastor? What are my motives for pastoring? Well, on one hand, I love God. I really do. I smoke what I sell. I am deeply desirous of others to know God. I think if you miss out on knowing God, you've missed out on the reason you're made in God's image, the reason why you exist. You are missing out on the, capital T-H-E, purpose of life. Everything else pales in comparison. I believe people should live the gospel and know the gospel and thrive in the gospel and find meaning in the gospel. So on the one hand, my motives are really good. On the other hand, I need money to eat. I really do. I need a place to live. I need some kind of security to know that I can do that with the freedom that it entails. And so, why do I do it? Why I love God, but I also need money. And you recognize that. Our denomination certainly does. I am, at the end of the day, a hired hand. This is true. It sometimes brings me to tears, because here's the truth of how we do things. You can stay in this congregation happily till the day you die. When I'm done being paid, I have to go. I'm not allowed to stay around here. I'm not really even supposed to interact with you guys that much for fear that that might harm the next pastor's ministry. You know how that works. So that's our way of, whether we want to say it or not, and whether we want to throw that other motive of doing it for pay, we all know at the end of the day, Jim Ekblad, Rich Vincent, hired hands. Hired hands. And when we're done paying them, they are going away. So, the motives are mixed. Let me expand that, because I want you to see this. I'm putting my head on the chopping block to help you perhaps see this in your own life. What I do up here, what I do in my ministry, but particularly in the act of preaching, I want to do as excellently as I possibly can. I put work into it. I want it to be as clear and as cogent and as helpful as it can possibly be. And I want to do that out of love for Christ, because I believe the message is that important. And I believe that anyone that makes the gospel boring has committed the ultimate sin. The ultimate sin. The gospel is anything but boring. So, I want to do it excellently. That's a good motive. On the other hand, I want to impress you. So you'll like me, and you'll feel you need me, because it's nice to be needed. Do you see the mixed motives? Now, I could pretend, as many do, that, oh, I'm just all pure motives. This is out of love for Christ and love for you. But the reality is, I know myself well enough, and anyone who looks at their heart and is willing to, knows that we're a mixed bag of motives in even the best things we do. And so, since it's so hard to assess our motives, we want to keep away from those kind of extremes. We don't want to delude ourselves and think, you know, our motives are so pure. Because the reality is, even Paul in Philippians 3 will say, I'm not already perfect. He knows he falls short. He'll say, I'm the chief of sinners in Timothy. He's fully aware that he is not perfect, but he is perfectly stumbling toward Christ. And so we don't want to delude ourselves with pure motives. You know, you've run into people like that before. You may have been like that before, and you know what kind of a blankety blank that makes you. When you kind of assume, oh, my motives are pure, yours not me. I'm the total package. I'm sold out. I'm the true Christian. This is the real gospel, da da da. You know that attitude, and it stinks to high heaven. So there's that side, but there's the also side, and I saw this a lot in my first ministry, of people immobilized by introspective motive examination. They simply wouldn't even do good things because they thought, you know, what if I go and serve the homeless, but I don't do it out of good motives? What if I'm dating this gal, but I'm not really doing it just because I want a good Christian wife, but I might want, you know. So I got that a lot. And you'd kind of see people literally stopped in their tracks from doing good because they couldn't possibly imagine doing it unless they could assess in their own introspective way that they were doing this from pure motives. That's why I love what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4. And we've already looked at this, but this is a good reminder of a passage that to me is so important for healthy pastoral ministry. Paul in 1 Corinthians 4 says, this is how you ought to regard us. And if you remember, he was talking about Apollos, Cephas, and all them in, under that I am Apollos controversy. He says, here's how you ought to regard us ministers. As servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. That's the best definition in short I know of. That a gospel minister is a servant of Christ, serving others in the name of and behalf of Christ, and a steward of the mysteries, which means that's the gospel mysteries. Preaching the gospel, speaking of the divine realities of the things of the Spirit, of the things of the Christ. Then Paul says, I care very little if I'm judged by you. Or examined by you, or by any human court. Indeed, I don't even examine myself. No morbid, ruthless self-examination of motives for Paul. Because for Paul, this is all he's concerned about. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. Because we all have a hard time assessing our motives. I might be wrong. It is the Lord who judges me, therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes, until the Lord returns. He will bring to light what is hidden in the darkness, and He will expose the motives of the heart. So leave it to the Lord, because you're probably going to get it wrong. And in fact, if you think you're right on this, you're going to really make it wrong for you and for many others. So Paul has this incredible way of looking at his own motives and realizing motives, they matter. But what matters more is the message. The message is far important, more important than the messenger, because the gospel has far more worth than the ministers that preach it, because God can work in spite of our bad motives, in spite of our flaws and failings. Again, that's why he says in verse 18, what does it matter? Christ is preached, whether out of false motives or true. That's Paul. Listen to him. Whatever the motives are, the message is what matters. And that then helps me, and I hope others, to not be too overly introspective. Fred Craddock, a master preacher and pastor, says more is at stake than how anyone feels. Too many genuine Christian witnesses and workers have been made to feel guilty because on a given day they labored simply from commitment or duty rather than a warm heart. So they just feel guilty. It's like, you know, I just did this because I had to. Well, let me assure you, I've done this for 27 years. There have been days when I've just got up here, I've got to do this. I have to do this. This is what I do. I don't feel like it. There have been difficult times of deep depression where for me, this gospel didn't connect at all, but I knew it was true. And I got up and did it. And one of the reasons that I did not feel guilt is because I've studied and I embraced this passage with my whole heart. That the issue for me is not to sit there and be overly introspective and say, well, I guess I shouldn't do this because I can't do it purely. For me, I've never done one pure thing in my life. And that's okay. Because what matters is Christ is preached. And that's what I'm trying to do. Not preach Rich Vincent. He's a dope. I'm trying to preach Christ. So Paul's take on this to me is very interesting. Now, you might hear all this and say, well, does Paul ever say anything about good motives? Well, of course he does. He'd prefer if the motives were good. He's not necessarily happy that people with bad motives are seeking to cause him issues. And that's why there are other passages we'll just breeze by them. But they're important for pastors and parishioners who want to have good motives. He says, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We don't use deception. We don't distort the word of God. On the contrary, you want to set the truth plainly before others so that their conscience might be challenged. And you see his desperate attempt to do things with right motives. In 1 Thessalonians, the first book he ever writes, he says, the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives. We're not trying to trick you, but we're also not trying to please you. We're not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know we never use flattery. We didn't put on a mask to cover up our greed. God is our witness. So I hope you see that even though Paul sees the message as more important than the messenger, he would like to make it so that the messenger, particularly himself first, and then those who follow his model, would try to not be greedy and envious and selfishly ambitious, and all these things he's challenging in the ones with the bad motives. So are you following on that? If you want to put it as simply as possible, doing the right thing matters much more than having the right motives. Hopefully your motives will get in line, but you need to do the right thing whether the motives are there or not, because the right thing's always the right thing. It's always the right thing. It's never not the right thing. Okay? It's not the right thing simply because your motives are bad. It's still the right thing. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, KG. I needed someone to get that. Okay. Finally, I find it interesting how Paul accepts the differences, particularly of these people who are trying to trouble his life. You know as well as I do, Paul has his enemies to this day. And back in his day, he had his enemies. Some of his enemies were Judaizers and preachers of the false gospel and people who indulged in other things. They were enemies for good reason. But Paul had enemies who shared his gospel. The same gospel he preached. They just didn't like Paul. And it's interesting that for Paul, even though these enemies share the same gospel, he doesn't belittle them because they're preaching the same gospel. Paul is delivered from any kind of preoccupation with other people's motives or opinions or criticisms, because in his mind, it's up to the Lord to judge. He'll analyze the message. He hopes that's right. But if the motives are a little bit afoul, he doesn't say anything bad about these people other than, hey, they don't like me. They're doing things from a very poor motive, and they're trying to cause me more suffering. But you know what? Christ is preached. And in this I rejoice. And because of that, I think there are many people, particularly ones I see on TV, particularly ones I hear on the radio, and there are others that I look at, and they have the same gospel I do, and I think, I really can't stand that person. I don't like them at all. I don't like their attitude. I don't like how they come. I don't like what they emphasize, da-da-da. But you know what? That's so wrong. Instead, I need to say, Christ is preached. And where Christ is preached, if I don't rejoice, I don't know Paul's sense of accepting differences. If everyone's got to preach with the same attitude and the same personality I have, woe be to the world for its absolute boringness. Instead, Paul's able to accept these differences and show unity and tolerance and love, even to those who are doing the right thing with a very wrong reason, including the wrong reason of they want to make Paul's life more difficult. He still says, hey, they want to make my life difficult? I rejoice. So we come to the conclusion, Paul's circumstances are bleak in our reading. He's locked away in prison. People on the outside are trying to make his life more difficult. And we know that it would have been easy for him to be discouraged because his plans had run afoul and that malicious people were trying to make his life difficult. But somehow Paul was able to change the narrative through his faith and understand that God can work even through adverse circumstances, which isn't surprising because Paul follows the crucified one. And it is in the horror and the ugliness and the injustice and brutality of the cross that God shines most brightly in demonstrating the divine love. So he's well aware that the divine power can be shown in the absolute darkness. And thus, that big story is allowing him to change his narrative, make lemon of lemonades, and rejoice when everyone else perhaps might not have been rejoicing. Which is why I want to leave with this last quote. This is by Tony Merida. He kind of takes all of this and tries to package it in one quote that's on one screen, and I'm done. He says at the end, "You should follow Paul." Here's why. He doesn't try to defend himself. He knows God will ultimately judge the hearts and ministries of people. So he simply stays focused on proclaiming Christ, and he puts the gospel first. You can't control what others think of you. All you can do is finish your race with faithfulness. And that's all Paul's doing. And in that, he models for not only his people, but for us. Would you pray with me?